Chapter 16. The door of his apartment was unlocked, and as he opened it, he could hear voices from inside. So she was home, he thought. He pushed the door so hard that it banged. But it was not Julie. In the living room of the apartment stood Bob Ross, smoking his pipe and looking at a motor magazine that he had picked up from the table. And in the other room was Chris Harmon. He was using the phone. Seeing Al, Harmon finished his phone call and hung up. He came into the living room and said, "We were just checking now, trying to locate your wife."
"I see," Al said. "Did you find her?"
Ross said,
"Apparently she's somewhere in Nevada, or possibly on the California side of Lake Tahoe. She may be at one of those lake resorts, such as Harrah's Club."
"She'll turn up," Harmon said in his easy, friendly voice. He smiled at Al, the smile that Al was familiar with. "But probably broke, but glad to be home again."
"What do you care?" Al said.
Harmon said, "You've suffered a lot of unnecessary loss in this, Al. I personally am very concerned that it be made up to you." Beside him, Ross nodded in agreement as he put down the motor magazine.
Al said, "What loss?"
"The humiliation," Harmon said, "for one thing." His hand moved. Ross, seeing the motion, ducked his head and started from the apartment out into the hall.
"I'll be along in about 15 minutes," Harmon said after him.
"I'll be in the car,"
Ross said and shut the door after him.
"I haven't suffered any humiliation," Al said. "Show me where I have."
"Perhaps the word's the wrong one. Pardon me if it is. I get a little clumsy sometimes when I try to express my deeper feelings. Bear with me." "You don't deserve what happened to you, Al. You know it, and I know it. Bob is aware of it. In fact, we were all discussing it last night when we learned that you had been picked up in Salt Lake City and were being held. My wife, Bodo, was especially concerned that something be done for you. I got in touch with Mrs. Ferguson's lawyer." Harmon paused and grinned, almost a grimace. "She's an incredible person, that Lydia. I had never met her before, of course, until this business. I must say it's a real experience to be around her for any length of time. But surprisingly, we found we had a great deal in common terms of interest. She's educated well beyond her external manner. Once you get down to the authentic person, it makes you anxious to know her much better." Al nodded. "She could hold her own in any salon," Harmon said. "Anywhere on the continent." Al nodded. "What's your attitude toward me?" Harmon said. Al shrugged. "Not too unfriendly," Harmon said. "Not something you can't get over in time. Although God knows you have no valid basis for any enmity toward me. But we'll let that pass. The mind is a strange instrument," he reflected. "At any rate," he said, pacing around the living room of the apartment, "I want to rehabilitate you." Al said,
"I see."
"I feel," Harmon said, "that it's my responsibility, in many ways. Some that you wouldn't understand." They both were silent.
"How do you mean, rehabilitate?" Al said. "You mean send me to a psychiatrist?"
"Oh, hell no," Harmon said. "What kind of rehabilitation is that? A perfunctory social means of providing custodial care, or some crackpot Freudian religion to make money off neurotic women. I mean through a decent job that will give you back your self-respect and dignity. By harnessing your ability," he added, "of which you have plenty, perhaps more than you realize."
"Would I work for your organization?" Al said. "Or do you mean you'd put in a word for me somewhere?"
"Frankly," Harmon said, meeting his gaze directly, I'd like to have you with me. But if you don't cotton to the notion... He shrugged, still smiling. It's okay with me. I'll see that you're put on somewhere else. He glanced at his watch. You have to go? Al said. Yes, in a minute. Jim's death was a terrible ordeal for all of us. God, he was so... Harmon gestured. Lively. Animated. Full of his old good spirits, like he was when I first started taking my cars to him. Cracking jokes. Yeah. Full of the old Jim, Al said. As if, Harmon said, what was left of him all sort of, how would you put it, boiled up at once and was consumed. There was nothing left after that. Really sad, Al said, and thought-provoking. Will you be thinking it over? Harmon said. About going back and picking up? I mean the job. Oh, yeah, Al said. Sure. Good boy, Harmon said. You know, Al, you always have to be able to pick up again. If you can learn that, you have it. If you can put adversity behind you and resume, resume and resume. Never stop resuming, because... Well, here's how I see it, Al. Nothing is that important. Not even death. You see? He nodded. Harmon's hand shot out and they shook. Then Harmon opened the hall door, waved, smiled a short, penetrating, official smile at him, and was gone. But then, almost at once, the door flew partway open and he was back. You have no fundamental hard feelings toward me, do you, Al? He said sharply. No, Al said. Nodding, Harmon shut the door. This time he was really gone. For a long time, Al stood at the window of the empty apartment by himself, watching the street below. Julie had not come back, even by 6, and by then he was becoming too hungry to stay any longer. He went into the kitchen and fooled with dishes and cans, but it was no use. So he wrote a note to her and left the apartment. As he came out onto the dark sidewalk, he saw a shape at work off in the shadows, bouncing up and down. At first he thought it was an animal, but it was Earl McKechnie, busy with some matter of his own, toiling as silently as usual. The boy raised his head as Al passed him. They looked at each other, said nothing, and then Al went on down the sidewalk, his hands in his pockets. A flapping sound made him pause at the corner. Behind him, at top speed, Earl McKechnie came running along the sidewalk, backward. He did not bump into anything, but veered as he came to each telephone pole and wall. He reached Al, danced around in a circle, and continued on, still backward, still avoiding all things.
"Hey," Al said, "how do you do it?"
Perhaps the kid had memorized the position of every object in the block. Not stopping, Earl yelled,
"I got my ring!"
He held up his hand. On his finger was a ring with a bit of glass in it, a mirror.
"My Captain Zero secret periscope ring."
Eyes fixed on his ring facing Al, he departed, hurrying deeper and deeper into the darkness until at last he was gone.
Really weird, Al thought. Can't make it out at all.
He continued on until he reached an Italian restaurant where he and Julie had often eaten. She was not there, but he went in and ordered dinner anyhow. After he'd eaten dinner, he roamed around the evening streets for a while, and then he turned in the direction of Tootie Doolittle's apartment.
"Hi," he said as Tootie let him in.
The Doolittles were still eating dinner. He saw the table with its dishes and pans and silver. Leading Tootie off to one side, he said,
"Listen, I want you to do something for me. I want you to get me something."
He wanted Tootie to get him a gun.
"That thing," Tootie said, "that we were discussing, you should have?"
"That's right," Al said.
Glancing at his wife, Tootie said in a low voice,
"Well, you can walk into a hardware store and buy one, ma'am."
"Oh," Al said.
"Only it'll be registered, and you know how they can do with those bullets."
Tootie's voice was virtually inaudible.
"You mean a gun what got found somewhere that nobody bought?"
"Yes," Al said.
"I don't know,"
Tootie said.
"Anyhow, come in and have some dinner."
He moved Al toward the table.
"How you do, Al?"
Mary Ellen Doolittle said as he seated himself.
"Welcome, and have something with us, please."
"Hi," Al said. "Thanks."
He had a little of the dumplings and lamb stew. Tootie had already put a plate, silver, a napkin, plastic cup, and saucer in front of him. Al stared down in bewilderment. The object seemed to materialize out of nothing.
"You look really tired,"
Mary Ellen said with sympathy.
"I think I'd never seen you so tired looking, Al."
Tootie said,
"They still after you?"
"No,"
Al said.
"They give up?"
"No," he said.
"They got me."
Tootie's eyes widened and then narrowed.
"Then you not here. You dead."
Picking at his dumplings and lamb stew, Al did not answer.
"I like to inquire," Mary Ellen said, "what this be about. But I know neither you boys ever going to say, so I save myself the bother. You going to go on the rest of your life like this, Al Miller? You not change as a result of the big-time job you got, I hear of?"
She waited, but he did not answer her either.
"No," she said, "you not."
"Al don't have the big-time job anymore anyhow," Tootie said, "so lay off him."
Mary Ellen said,
"Well, Al Miller, eat up your dinner and then go on."
He glanced at her. She was serious.
"She mean it," Tootie said. "She given up on you. I seen her give up on people before, but I surprised at her at this point. Is that the true way of God, to throw a man out? I say to hell with that and all the Uncle Tom religion you spout."
Tootie's voice rose until the dishes rattled. Mary Ellen shrank away, but she did not try to break in.
"I'm really sick of you,"
Tootie shouted at her.
"You the hopeless one. You get out. You hear? You hear me?"
He yelled with his face close to hers until at last she scrambled to her feet.
"Go on,"
he yelled, jumping up.
"Leave here and don't come around again."
Then he dropped back down into his chair. He grabbed his coffee cup, squeezed it between both his dark palms, and then he slammed it from the table, skidding it across the floor so that it burst against the wall. Streamers of coffee appeared on the wall, as high as the picture of Jesus, which Al had seen there as long as he had known them.
"You through?"
Mary Ellen said presently.
"What do you know about old Al?" Tootie said. "Nothing."
His face had a stern, brooding expression. He shook his head.
"Nothing at all." "Well, I didn't mean to stir up any trouble," Al said, going on with his eating.
It had shaken him that Mary Ellen had ordered him out. He could not bring himself to look at her, but now she came over and put her hand on his shoulder.
"Maybe I did done wrong," she said.
Her fingers caressed his shoulder, guileless fingers.
"Listen, Al,"
she said, drawing her chair over so that she was seated so close to him that her knees pressed against the rungs of his chair.
"I see it," what Tootie said, "and I saw it when you came in, all over him,"
she said to her husband,
"in him and around him."
"See what?" Al said.
"That you're going to die soon,"
Mary Ellen said.
"Oh,"
Al said.
"It don't even bother you,"
Mary Ellen said softly.
"Nope,"
he agreed.
"Do something,"
Mary Ellen said. He went on eating. When he had finished, he got up from the table.
"How about it?"
he said to Tootie. Still brooding, still clasping and unclasping his hands, Tootie said,
"No."
"Really?" Al said. "You won't get it for me?"
"No,"
Tootie repeated.
"So long, then," Al said.
"I tell you why," Tootie said. "You think you want it for getting back at them, but when you get your hands on it..."
He studied the remains of the coffee cup and the spilled coffee.
"Then you take it and stick it against your head and you give it to yourself. You not know that now. You not admit it or face it, but it's still true."
"Is it?" Al wondered. "Maybe so. You haven't seen anything of my wife, have you?" he asked him. "She hasn't called here."
"No," Mary Ellen said. "Don't you know where she is?" Tootie said,
"Did she leave you, man?"
"Maybe," Al said.
"You just a Humpty Dumpty," Tootie said. "You just stand there, stand around while it all happened to you. You just perch and watch. So now you don't even have a wife. A nice wife like that."
"Why don't you go and look for her?" Mary Ellen said. Tootie said,
"I bawled Mary Ellen out because she asked you to leave. Now I think she right. You want to leave. You want to go out and make it, and then come back and sit here. Okay?"
Putting on his jacket, Al left the apartment. They were both watching him as he shut the door after him. He stood by the ruins of the Marmon, kicking at a cylinder that had been part of the ignition system. Most of the lot lay in darkness, but the neon sign of the coffee shop across the street gave him enough light to see again what he had already seen before. There was no hope of restoring the Marmon. Whoever had wrecked it knew what he was doing. The idea that had come grotesquely into his mind, it couldn't be done, at least not without several weeks of work, and by then it wouldn't matter. He had seen himself driving the ruined Marmon down the freeway, late, in the part of the night when there was the least traffic, all the way to Richmond Bridge, and then at 75 miles an hour, into the steel and concrete side of the bridge, and through and down into the water. But it was out of the question, and anyhow it was only a vision, a dream of his own death. "A hearse," he thought. "All this time, all these months, was that what I was restoring it to be? A big, black, heavy, silent hearse, wheeling along the deserted streets with me in it, on my back with my hands folded, my eyes open wide, my tongue possibly sticking out a half inch, stiff, swollen, unless the undertaker pushed it back in or snipped it off. Me, sticking out my tongue as they dragged me up the street, my tongue out at them even in death. The sons of bitches." And then he had another dream, another vision. This one was so clear that he at once began to work on it. He did not hesitate. He hurried to the little basalt blockhouse, unlocked the door, and began searching around until he had found a paper bag left over from a lunch. He carried the paper bag outside and, stooping down, began to sweep up sand from the lot. The sand had been put there to collect grease dripping from his cars. He swept it with his hands, pushing it into a pile, and then dumped the sand into the paper bag. "Maybe I can get both of them," he said to himself, "the Mercedes-Benz and the Cadillac. Unless," he thought, "they have locks on the gas tanks." He could not remember. While he stood there at the edge of the lot, holding the paper bag of sand and trying to remember, a car horn honked. He turned and saw an old but polished Cadillac at the curb. It had stopped, and the driver was watching him. He saw in the reflected streetlight the driver's eyes. Rolling the car window down, the driver leaned over and called out to him,
"Hi!"
It was a woman. For an instant he had it that she was his wife.
He leapt all over and started toward her. But it was not Julie, and he knew that. It was Mrs. Lane. He went on toward her anyhow, more slowly, taking his bag of sand with him. He stood on the sidewalk, saying nothing.
"Hello there, Mr. Miller,"
Mrs. Lane said, her lips drawing back to show her carved golden teeth. The club and diamonds sparkled.
"What you doing down here in the dark? You appear to be having to pick up something you drop."
He said nothing. "You want me to drive up on the lot so my headlights make it show up better?" she said.
"No,"
he said.
"Thanks."
"Guess what I doing,"
she said, still leaning toward him. Now he could smell her perfume. It was so intense that it came out of the car and around him where he stood.
"Here, I show you."
She shut off the motor of the Cadillac, squirmed over, opened the door on his side, and stepped out. She had on a knit dress and high heels and a hat. She was dressed up, obviously going out somewhere.
"Don't you think I look good?"
she said. "Yes," he agreed. He had never seen her so spruced up, so sleek. Her hair, her skin, her eyes, everything about her shone. She had one single piece of jewelry on, a brooch near her collar.
"I've been on a diet," she said. "I don't even have a, if you don't mind my saying it, a panty girdle."
She patted her stomach.
"I flat," she said, "flat as a griddle pan, after all these years. I'm flatter than a lot of those high school girls that go by eating those popsicles and sticking out and hunching."
She laughed. Turning in the streetlight, she showed him with no need of comment that she had on no bra either.
"Fact is," she said, "I need nothing under this, and that exactly what I got on."
She raised her arms and skipped a step or two.
"Nothing at all," he agreed.
"Whee!" she said, her eyes glowing.
"Where's your husband?" he said.
"Oh, him," she said. "He gone. He a contractor up in Shasta County seeing about an important public building. He be back in another week. I going to a party."
Her voice lilted and rose.
"Goodbye," she said, reopening the car door. "I got a scoot. I just see you working away, and I stopped to show off.
Don't get a chance every day."
"You look fine," he said. She said, "Mr. Miller, you sound so bad. Where all your usual jokes and ironic style of humor?"
He shrugged.
"No more," Mrs. Lane said, regarding him. "Is that it? I hear about Mr. Ferguson. Now where you go, what you do?"
"I'm looking for my wife," he said.
"She gone, too? Everybody gone? Nobody wants you, it seem. No wife, no friend, no job. You in a bad way. How'd you get that way, Mr. Miller? Life perplexing in certain regards. One day you have all those things, the next day not. And what you done in between? Far as I can see, you not done nothing at all. Sometime it make you ponder if not those church people not right. But I, myself, I never go to church and believe nothing. I already had that, and it just the same as all the rest. I think you and I be crazy to go back to that, as much as we wish we could, like other folk."
He nodded.
"What in the package?" she said.
He did not know what she meant. He looked around.
"In your hand," she said.
He showed her.
"Sand,"
she said, looking into it as he held it open.
"You picking up sand like a little boy."
She took the sack of sand away from him and set it down by one of the parked cars.
"That all you get out of this? At your age? 30-something years? No wonder you got nothing joking to say. And here I, going out to my party. I going to get in and drive off leaving you. And I even take your sack of sand away from you. I a bad woman if I do that. I really bad. I see myself in my jangly skin laughing out. My mean, jangly skin."
"That's okay," he said. "I wasn't getting anywhere. Forget it."
"You not begrudge me my party," she said. "I know that, Mr. Miller." After a moment, she reached out and took hold of his wrist. "I think I take you with me," she said.
"Where to?" he said.
"Not to no old party. I take you home with me." She pulled him, and he went along across the sidewalk to the car. Opening the car door, she sat him down on the seat, and then she went around to the other side and got in behind the wheel.
"I drive," she said to him, "because I know the way."
She started the motor. He reached out and put his arms around her.
"Yes," she said, "I really look good tonight. I don't think I look this good ever in 15 years.
She drew him against her, holding him against her shoulder and patting him. Then she put the car in gear and drove, holding the wheel with her left hand.
"It's a good thing I got automatic transmission on this," she said, "or long before now I run into somebody while changing gear."
Soon they were traveling through streets he had never seen before, streets that he did not know.
"I never hit anybody yet," Mrs. Lane said.
That is the end of Humpty Dumpty in Oakland by Philip K. Dick.